Registry Matters is an independent production. The opinions and ideas here are that of the host and do not reflect the opinions of any other organization. If you have problems with these thoughts, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West. Transmitting across the internet, this is episode 194 of Registry Matters. We've been doing time warp stuff, Larry. My brain is very confused about trying to pretend that it's this time versus that time, but this is actually Saturday night, September 18th, right?
I think so.
I did receive a comment from someone that listened to our Patreon extra that we're going to actually talk a little bit about later, that they normally listen to podcasts at a very accelerated rate. On podcast apps, you can accelerate them to 1.1 speed or 2. This is compressing it by like 10 and 20, and this person normally listens to it at 40%, so you knock out an hour-long podcast in like 40 minutes. I talk too fast for this speed that it turns into gibberish. No comment? Nothing?
You think so? You think so, do you?
That's what they said. I don't have anything else that I can even comment on it. Well, Mr. Larry, what do we have going on this evening?
Well, we're all over the map. We've got questions from people that are in custody. I'm trying to figure out the politically correct term because I never get it right. Incarcerated individuals. We have questions from people who are not incarcerated individuals. We have a letter to a state legislator to talk about. We have an update on a case out of Pennsylvania. And we have one article about a 12-year sentence for coupon fraud. And we have...
for coupon fraud? Way to, like, get Al Capone or something. Okay.
And I think we have some comments about our polygraph episode that we recently did.
Yes, we do. Fantastic. Well, let's dive right in, Larry. The first thing that we have is a question from someone that is in Illinois. And he says, Dear Narsal, it says, my question for you for your organization is the following. What are the rules and regulations and laws for the state of Illinois? I need to know, the second question is, I need to know if there are any states without sex offender registration laws, if any. I would like the laws, regulations, and rules for all of the United States, one that you're able to retrieve for me. Finally, any lawyers in the state of Illinois that represent PFRs, hopefully pro bono, and then respectfully. Wow, Larry, they're kind of asking for all of the wiki site that Narsal has with all of the rules and regulations for all 50 states, which I don't even know that Narsal has all 50 states published in there. There are probably some gaps.
Well, I'm going to take the easy ones. Number 4, any lawyers in the state of Illinois that represent PFRs, hopefully pro bono, that's going to be a tall order. Probably not going to find that very easily. So we've done one question. Any states that don't have registration laws, there's no state in the United States that doesn't have a registration law. So we've knocked out 2 of them. Now, within the United States, there are states that have less onerous laws, but every state registers and every state has some portion or all of their offenders on the internet. But there's no state without a registry. So we've knocked out 2 of them. The rules and regulations for the state of Illinois, I'm going to send them. They're in the Dropbox folder. I'm going to send them to this writer. I get to plug another site that really annoys people. It's the Class Kids Foundation, which most people would not find them PFR friendly because they are for more strict laws. But they have, as far as I'm concerned, the best resource. It's not a perfect resource, but it's the best resource, where you can readily assimilate the information because they get it straight directly from the state itself. They're in constant contact with the state registrars, and they get the number of people registered and the current iteration of the law. So I have produced a copy from that website, compliments of the Class Kids Foundation, and I'm going to send that to him. So that takes care of the rules and regulations from for Illinois, the rules for the entire country, I mean, that's just not doable. I mean, we would have to send you a UPS truck with all of that.
That would be a lot.
So, but there's a lot of similarities in the registries. You know, there's when you take out the states that are eminently reasonable, then there's a lot of similarities beyond that. You know, they're just consistent what you have to do. So if you have gotten any information about registering one state, it's very similar in another state.
And almost just states that are nearby are very similar to their neighbors, kind of, sort of, generally. If you're in the Southeast, they're all basically kind of crappy, with this one has extra restrictions here, this one has extra restrictions there.
Generally true. Now, in the case of like Georgia, the registry is not as harsh as the surrounding states. And you've got Georgia legislators who think that Georgia should be similar to the other states. And in fact, there was legislation to make the removal process in Georgia more difficult, to make it more consistent with the surrounding states. Like, for example, in Alabama, you can't be removed. But the states that do have removal processes, Georgia has a more reasonable process than the surrounding states. So amazingly, Georgia wants to be like other states when it comes to some things.
American exceptionalism, man. Let's be exceptional at making this just diabolically terrible across the board. Is that all for this particular question before we move on?
That's the best I can do, but I will send that to the writer, that Illinois will, the FYP Education Administrative Division will make sure that he gets that.
The FYP Education Administrative Division. Wow, I didn't realize we had staff, Larry.
Well, we have to make ourselves sound really official at FYP.
That's awesome. All right. Well, then question number two. Let's see here. It says, to the Narsaw Legal Corner. I am serving out a 25-year sentence in Kentucky Department of Corrections. When released, I'll be on conditional discharge for 5 years after serving 85% of my sentence. I have very little family left, and what family I do have is now in Illinois. I'd like to do an interstate compact to Illinois, but I have no access to Illinois law here in Kentucky. I don't know if Illinois has codes or statutes or what the laws are on PFRs coming from other states on conditional discharge. I also have no access to Illinois registry. Please send me info to contact necessary people to get info I need on Illinois registry and laws. I know some states, you're better staying where you are at because of the registry laws. How do I find out if this applies to me going to Illinois from Kentucky? And thank you.
I like that question because it builds upon the previous question, but I can use the same resource, which I will. But it allows us to talk about the Interstate Compact, which is always an interesting issue for our listeners, particularly for our prison audience. He is very fortunate in that Kentucky does not charge an outbound application fee. And I did that research before the program. Oftentimes, the state that you're in that you want to apply from, known as the sending state, they impose these huge fees. Kentucky's got it right. There's no fee for a parolee. There's no fee for a probationer. He is correct. He'll have to apply for the interstate compact because if your post-prison conditions include any reporting, it doesn't matter what they name it. They're calling it, well, if you look above here, they're not calling it parole. They're calling it conditional discharge. That's one of the deficiencies in the old interstate probation parole compact that was improved by this present compact, the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision, because every name that a state has may be different. The key that determines whether you're going to have to use that vehicle of interstate compact is whether you have a reporting obligation. And if you have a reporting obligation, you're a covered offender. So he will be required to do the interstate compact. Fortunate for him, there's no fee.
Oh, that's
and
cool.
when he gets to Illinois, if he's accepted, if he has sponsors, they have some strict residency rules, apparently, from what we've heard from our audience. But if he is able to be accepted, he will have the registration requirements of Illinois. Kentucky is no longer in the picture because he's not going to be living there, but he'll be required to comply with the registration statute as it exists in Illinois. And His supervision requirements will be what Kentucky imposed plus what Illinois wants to add that's consistent with how they supervise their PFRs. So he may pick up additional conditions, but he will definitely have the conditions that Kentucky gives on him for his conditional discharge conditions. When he signs that paperwork that allows him to leave Kentucky prison, those conditions follow. They don't go away. As I've said before, wouldn't it be magnificent if you could change your sentence by just simply crossing state boundaries? You can't do that. So those conditions will follow you.
Okay. What are we able to send? And I know that this is coming from the NARSAL legal corner. So what is FYP going to be able to do? And what is NARSAL going to send on his behalf?
Well, NARSAL will send a letter saying that we answered this on the REM podcast episode 194, and that he will receive the transcript of 194, as well as the one that says Illinois SORNA and Dropbox. And that came from the Class Foundation website, and it'll explain the basics of Illinois registration. So that's what the two people from Illinois that are interested in Illinois will get. They'll get this transcript plus the Illinois page from the Class Foundation website.
Larry, you put two things in here related to Illinois. This sounds like you're kind of cheating.
Well, I don't control who writes us.
All right. This one is a very disturbing letter. This comes from an individual in Kentucky. It says, again, to whom it may concern, hi, I'm an inmate at the Luther Luckett Correctional Complex in LaGrange, Kentucky. My name is blah, blah, blah. I'm doing 8 years on second degree rape. Since I have made it to prison, I have been treated badly. Other inmates steal all my things, call me names and all kinds of different things. Plus, almost 1 month ago, I got raped by, it's been redacted, one of the inmates. And they do not have PC here. PC is protective custody. So I'm in the hole, which I think is protective custody, except for you probably have a bunkmate. And I've been in here for the last 23 days with only a smock to wear, and I'm waiting to get shipped to a different prison. The inmate that raped me is a gang member, and I asked for PC, and I got denied. So now I have to go to a different prison where I will possibly have to fight because the inmates put a hit on me, maybe even get killed. I don't know, but I'm scared for my life. I do not find it right that inmates with any kind of sexual charges get treated very badly. They hate to pay to walk the yard or do sexual favors. I'm sorry, they have to pay to walk the yard or do sexual favors. And if not, they get treated bad, get everything stolen from them. It's not right that we get treated like this on my way to protect oneself. Will you help me change this, please? And thank you. And oh my God. So there's PREA, Larry. There's the Prison Rape Elimination Act. And I'm not saying it doesn't happen, but, and that might only, that's a federal thing. Does that apply to the states?
Well, it's a goal for the states to get their precious resources. I understand it. If they can show that they've taken these steps to eliminate or reduce, you're never going to eliminate, but to reduce prison violence, in particular rape. I feel bad for this guy. I don't know what we can offer him. I put this in here mainly because I want to pose the question. I've never been to prison, but I find it appalling what the hierarchies are in prison. And I know what this podcast isn't going to change any of that. But I find it appalling that the people who kill are at the top of the pecking order, the food chain. They're admired, as I understand it. And the people, they have this hierarchy of disgusting individuals, and PFRs are at the very bottom of the pecking order in terms of what he's describing. This is not all that uncommon. I'm not saying it's common. It happens in every prison, but I hear quite a bit of this. And what really puzzles me, it's prisoners are forever filing grievances about due process and presumption of innocence and ineffective assistance of counsel, and that they should be treated. They constantly complain about collective punishment. You name it, prisoners are complaining all the time. If you want people to respect you, why is it that you, and this is the rhetorical question for you people behind the walls, I would like you to write and tell me how these hierarchies come to be. And why is it that you demand to be treated with respect and with due process and all this, but yet you don't treat anybody with any presumption. A person gets arrested, even pre-trial, and they get thrown into a county jail. If it's determined that that it's a sexual charge, they get beat and all sorts of things because they're automatically presumed guilty. But yet you turn around and you say, don't presume me guilty. I'm entitled to this. I have no idea how to explain it. I think you've been to prison before. Do you have any insight as to where this culture comes from and how it is that they demand that they be treated, but yet they don't treat anybody with the same thing they demand for themselves?
The answer that I have is certain, like my experience and then all of those around me, I don't know, maybe they were camps that had a high number of people there with these kinds of charges. So like, then it was just like, it wasn't a one-off, but I never had a problem. But is that because I'm tall and maybe broad-shouldered? I don't want to say that the person that we're talking about looks soft, because I know nothing of this, but they decided to target this person. And I mean, once you get the guise of gangs, once you're on their radar, you are, he's going to have problems probably in every place that he's at. And that's all I could really speak to is I made friends, I guess you could say. I had store call, so like I didn't pay the piper, but I just was, hey, you need a soup? And man, look, don't go hungry on the weekends. Georgia only feeds you 4 times a week. So if somebody needed a soup, I always had an extra soup in my box to give people. So I was generous in that regard, and maybe that kept me off the radar. I kept to myself. I didn't bother anybody. But I don't, like, once you end up on there as a target, I don't know what to tell you.
Well, and I'm going to have to, I think I heard you say Georgia only feeds you 4 times a week. There's 21 yes. general meal. So 21 meals a week, Georgia reduces it to 4 a week from 21?
It's 4 days a week. So you get 3 meals. I'm sorry. I only mean that on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, you get breakfast and dinner. You don't get lunch because since nobody's working, no one's going to education. All you need to do is just lay there in your bunk. So you don't have any of the extra calorie requirements. So we can drop you at a 600 calorie lunch or 400 calorie lunch.
So there's no lunch on Friday or Saturday or Sunday at Georgia prison.
Correct.
I did not realize that.
Yeah. And pretty much all programs, I guess is what they call them. Everything as far as any vocational classes, any GD classes, none of that stuff happens. Which, again, like I said, I think that's just an excuse to have fewer staff to keep you just locked in the dorm or in your cell, not cell, but just in the dorm for the weekend. There's not any extra yard call or anything like that. It's just completely like everything's a holiday and everything is shut down for the most part. It's like I said, they're shutting down on having lunch, which all they're giving you is 4 slices of bread, 2 pieces of bologna or something like that, and like 4 ounces of some sort of fruit cup. It's really not that much of a lunch anyway.
Well, I tell you, you should have thought about that before you got locked up.
Without a doubt. I will tell you, though, that at some point in time when I was in the Army, I remember driving through, I want to say it was Texas, and saw people on an actual chain gang and like 10 guys all strapped together with like hose, and they were beating on the ground, you know, doing a farming kind of stuff. And I was like, yeah, that's what those people should be doing for breaking the law. That's karma for you, right?
So, well, I have a slightly different view. I mean, when we put someone in a cage and they cannot fend for themselves, we have a duty to take care of them. That includes their safety, their nutrition, and their health. And that's part of the cost of caging people. When you don't allow them to take care of themselves, you have to assume that responsibility. So feeding them is one of the things that's required. So.
I gotcha. The other thing, so the Prison Rape Elimination Act, as far as I understand it, is something that this person should be able to file some kind of very heavy grievance. Like what, I don't know what, I don't, it's not a charge, you're not charged. I mean, maybe you're charging the prison because they're in charge of protecting you to a certain degree, that they should be aware of this and they should be able to respond to it to keep you to some degree safe. It is prison, so it's not always going to be safe. But that's what that whole act is. And at least here, they made a big stink about it. If you have problems, then you should be able to talk to somebody and elevate and escalate that really quickly. Certainly not an expert and don't want to even be considered this, but I'm pretty sure there's a chain of command. There's a procedure that you should be able to get assistance in this regard if you've been raped.
Isn't that only going to bring more problems to him, though? Because doesn't he become a snitch then, that he goes to the man for protection?
Well, then how did he end up asking for PC? And then they say they don't have PC. So he just said, I need PC because I don't feel safe. He didn't say. I don't know the details of this. Like, yeah, then you get labeled a snitch. And that certainly becomes far worse for you as well. All right. But I'm deeply sorry for this person.
My point about prisons is that if we're going to cage as many people as we do in this country, and we are the top in the world, I mean, the graphs of nations that we identify ourselves as being similar to, we are so far beyond anything of our comparable allies in terms of our rates of incarceration. If you're going to do that, folks, be prepared to pay the bill for it. These people cannot protect themselves. Yep. There are mean people in there. Everybody in prison is not a mean gangster. They're just trying to serve their time. If you're going to put people in these cages, be prepared to pay for enough staff to oversee them, to keep them safe. Be prepared to pay for their health care. Be prepared to pay for their nutrition. Be prepared to do these things. And if you're not prepared to do this, then you might ought to talk to your elected officials about having fewer people in custody, because one of the things that makes prisons difficult to manage among many is overcrowding and too many people. Every system in a prison breaks down when you have overcrowding. They're designed for a certain number. And actually, ideally, a prison will never run at capacity, because when you're running at full capacity, that's stressing everything. In security classifications, although you may have 1,000 cells for just round numbers, of the capacity of 1,000 beds doesn't mean that those beds allocate to the type of inmates you have. So you may need more beds for one type of classification and fewer for another. You see what I'm saying?
I do.
So you may end up having beds that are empty, bunks that are empty, because they're in the wrong classification.
So that almost means that you have to have some kind of 10 or 20% extra capacity in the whole system, where Georgia's running at like 105 or 110% of capacity.
Correct. Prisons ought to not be at capacity. And folks, if you want everybody locked up, it's going to cost you some money to do it.
Okay, then. Well, we are going to move on. PREA. That's all I got to say is PREA, Prison Rape Elimination Act. And maybe on that, I'm being naive as to how effective it is. And anyway, so we'll drop that. Here we have a letter that you put in there. This is a letter from a constituent in the New Mexico. My name is Redacted, and I live in Albuquerque, New Mexico. I am a senior at New Mexico Highland University under the social work program, and I'm also an advocate for Casa Fortaleza, a nonprofit organization for sexual abuse awareness and prevention. I'm writing you regarding New Mexico Statute 30-1-8 for ages 18 and older, which sets a 6-year statute of limitations for commencing criminal prosecution against sexual offense. I'm aware that in the 2020 New Mexico government session, you proposed to revise the bill for the statute of limitations for sexual abuse of minors, but did not obtain a majority vote. It is sad to hear about the outcome, since data suggests that sexual assault and rape continue to be a public health and a public safety problem in New Mexico. In 2018, New Mexico ranked as the 7th nationwide for most rape and sexual assault cases, and 3,640 sexual assault incidents were reported to law enforcement agencies. In 2013, the cost of reported rape alone in New Mexico was close to $219 million. On the other hand, in 2018, only 34% of sex crimes in New Mexico were reported to law enforcement. According to the U.S. Bureau of Justice Statistics, it is believed that only 15.8% to 35%, that's a big range, 35% of all sexual assaults are reported to the police. Victims find themselves in denial, shock, or still are confused about what happened and fail to report the crime to law enforcement. Hence, because sexual assault and rape crimes are underreported, New Mexico Statute 30-1-8 is not effective for all. Jessica, my eldest sister, as an example, was raped in 2009 by a Christian pastor when she was 37 years old. He claimed to be a man of God, and there was much confusion in Jessica's mind after the assault. It was not until recently, in 2019, that she reported the abuse to the police. However, the police report noted that the case was out of the criminal statute of limitations. Supporters of New Mexico Statute 30-1-8 argue that a longer interval to commence a criminal charge against the offender can alter the physical evidence, while a reasonable time gives the offender a just conviction. However, an expiration date to a sexual assault also denies the victim time to seek justice through the legal system. Consequently, the statute should be amended to unlimited statute of limitations on sexual assault crimes. Can we amend this law? In this way, New Mexico citizens will know the problem is being attended to by their state legislatures. Thank you very much for taking the time to read this letter and your consideration. Boy, oh boy, Larry, I know that you are going to have some things to say about this.
I am indeed. I agree with her on the underreporting. I can't confirm the numbers. I don't know that, but there are a lot of sexual crimes that are not reported. Sometimes they only become a crime after the person is coached to believe that a crime was committed. And sometimes they're not reported because of the things that she listed. But regardless of the reason why they're not reported, I will say this. A fair trial becomes more and more difficult with the passage of time. Our system is intended to be fair to not only to you, the victim. It is intended to be fair to the accused. We are trying not to cage people without solid, reliable evidence. As time passes, that evidence is not solid and reliable. Witnesses die. Their memories fade. Physical evidence is lost or tainted. So many things go wrong as a case ages. Alibi witnesses, if they're not there, and I think that I ended up coming down on the side of Judge Moore in Alabama. Was it Judge Moore that ran for Senate and had somebody yes. ran for Senate in Alabama?
Doug Moore is his name.
That had old
40-year-old allegation of consensual sex with a minor, or at least a relationship, an inappropriate relationship with whatever. He was 30 as the DA in Alabama, and the girl was 15. The family was all on board with it, but they wanted to call him out for being a dirtbag.
And I said the same thing. So it's not political, although there'll be listeners out there that'll try to say it's political. It's about fair trial. Our process is supposed to be fair to all the parties, not just the victims. As a victim, that's hard to understand because I've been a victim of a violent crime, and I struggled with that. I really did, because I couldn't understand why the person that was accused of the assault was getting so much consideration. I was very young and I didn't understand it. But before we put that person in a cage and ultimately the grand jury nobled it for him. But before you put that person in the cage, they're entitled to the presumption of innocence, robust defense, and they can't get that robust defense as the decades wear on. So for whatever it's worth, I will be opposing this letter writer. But there will be enormous pressure from the victim's advocates. This is an example of the mail that comes in on a regular basis prior to and during the sessions. And this is an issue. If you find yourself on the wrong side, it's politically almost suicidal if you find yourself on the wrong side of the issue, because they come in crying and telling how their life was forever destroyed because they didn't report this. And it held back their success. And I mean, it's just unbelievable the things that they say. And you can't say anything. The lawmakers can't say anything to question them, because that would play very well on YouTube, don't you think?
Oh, yeah.
So this is a difficult position. The states are under, the legislators of all the states that still have statute of limitations are under enormous pressure. Now, because of some high-profile cases, some of the states have already eliminated them. You know, we talked about Illinois with Dennis Hastert, the former Speaker of the House. And you've got all these high-profile cases with Dr. Nassar. And what was the coach's name in Pennsylvania?
Sandusky.
You've got all these people that have caused these overreactions, in my view. My opinion is that abolition of statute of limitations is an overreaction.
Didn't New York make it 50 years or something like that?
They did indeed change it. I can't say specifically, but this is a nationwide thing. Your state, if it hasn't done it, will be facing this type of effort. And we're no exception. And I just wanted people to know that this is the type of thing as a PFR. If you're already convicted, you may think it doesn't matter, but it does, even if you're already convicted. Right. Because guess what? There may be old allegations lurking in your past that may be able to put you back in prison. So rather than having this thing about going to Hooters and staying under the radar, you don't need to be paying attention to this because this may come back for you.
I think I probably shouldn't chime in because I'll get all the hate mail.
Well, I'm sure I'll get some, but yeah, we're on the Constitution. I mean, to me, this is a constitutional issue. Although the statute of limitations is not in the Constitution, but what is in the Constitution is the presumption of innocence and the fundamental fairness. And you can't have a fair trial with evidence that's decades old. You really can't.
I gotcha.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
Well, Larry, we are going to now talk about this thing from Pennsylvania. So you people put this document in here today and didn't give me any time to read it and tell me that it was coming up. And this is a case named Lacey Stratford et al. Versus John Wetzel, the Secretary of Pennsylvania Department of Corrections. I thought this case should be sounded very familiar, so I checked out our FYP archives. Yes, just a little while ago in 168, recorded back in March. I'm guessing that you want to update some folks on aspects of this case, since it was just a few months ago. What was the case about?
It was about different things related to PFRs.
Great. That's helpful.
We discussed it on episode 168, which everybody didn't hear or everybody didn't read. So it was, as we discussed, a district court's opinion. The plaintiffs claimed that although they had been granted parole, that their release from prison and placement in DOC-operated halfway houses had been significantly delayed because of the DOC's policy of considering community sensitivity to a criminal offense in making these placements. And because the consideration of community sensitivity disproportionately delays placement of parolees with the sex offense classification, the plaintiffs have been subject to prolonged incarceration following the grant of parole. So this means that they have been approved for parole, but the parole board has decided that the community sensitivity is too high and they just can't place these people anywhere. So these individuals with that classification have had to endure prolonged incarceration. So that's what this case was about.
I see. And I read the order and it contains several components. The first of it is the order prohibits the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections from considering the community sensitivity or opposition when deciding on CCC or CCF placement. Can you remind me what the audience what that is?
Community Corrections Center or Community Corrections Facility.
I see. Okay. Well, that helps. And then... you have more to go on with that, don't you?
So, yes, they have been ordered to stop doing what they had long done with PFRs. So the court had previously held the DLC's policy of considering community sensitivity and delaying the release of parolees with a sex offense classification on that basis violates the Equal Protection Clause and the 14th Amendment. The court further noted that the DLC's concern with community sensitivity is not a legitimate basis for delaying PFR's release following a positive parole action. So that's what this order is. That's the first component of this order. They've been ordered to stop doing that.
I vaguely recall that the district court's opinion regarding community sensitivity was based on a decision from the U.S. Supreme Court. Do I have that right?
You do. That's exactly what they said in the opinion that we talked about back in March, and I believe it was on page 15 from my notes. But yes, the district court's opinion stated that the Supreme Court has recognized that mere negative attitudes or fear unsubstantiated by factors which are properly cognizable are not permissible basis for treating one group differently from another. And they base it on a case of city of Claiborne. And I didn't look that case up, but that was in the decision. So I don't know the details, but that was a U.S. Court decision that they based that upon.
All right. Well, then, Larry, if I recall correctly, the DOC asserted that it has legitimate interest in ensuring that no one CCC and surrounding community be required to house a disproportionate number of PFRs. The DOC also claimed, without evidence, that if it were to release PFRs without delay at the same pace as other offenders, the CCCs would be overburdened with PFRs, which would in turn overburden the communities in which the CCCs are located. If the community's sensitivity to this category of individual cannot justify the differential treatment of one PFR, then it follows that it cannot justify the differential treatment of multiple PFRs. Isn't that what the next segment of the order addresses?
Yes, it is. The court ordered the Department of Corrections Secretary to direct the Bureau of Community Corrections, the BCC, to review at this time the DOC's pending release on parole list and to reevaluate individuals that have been on the list for the greatest length of time since a referral was made to the BCC following the issuance of a positive parole action.
Does this mean that the people will finally get out of prison?
It depends on what you mean by the word finally. I do not expect the Pennsylvania Department of Corrections will be in a rush to effectuate this order. If you read the following sentences of the order, you see there's additional opportunity for them to stall, which is exactly what I expect they will do.
So just to clarify, these are people that have been told by the Department of Corrections that they can parole out, and parole, in my mind, is like you're still in prison, but they have let you out. So you're not inside, confined inside the walls, but you still have a lot of those same sort of rules. Anyway, and they all have to go to one of these, like a halfway house kind of place?
Well, apparently that is where most likely most of the people end up going. Since I'm not in that state, but apparently that's their transition to the community when they make parole. But these are people who have met all the therapeutic obligations, as we discussed in 168. They've done all the things, and they've gotten the parole favorable recommendation. They've been approved, but in order not to inconvenience the communities and disturb their sensitivity, they've decided to continue to hold them in prison because of those community factors. Well, they've been ordered to cease doing that and to expedite these people's release. I don't think they're going to do it, but that's what they've been ordered to do.
But if they're not letting them out just because they don't have a place to go, I mean, I guess parole is a privilege. I think that's probably where this goes, isn't it? That it's a privilege for them to not be confined inside the walls?
Well, they do have a place to go. They will not put them in the CCCs that have beds because they don't want to disturb the community sensitivity. It's not because there's not open beds, it's because they don't want too many PFRs in a particular CCC or CCF.
Interesting. It seems like this is almost like what we will talk about when you get placed on civil commitment. Hey, today's your day that you're getting released. Oh wait, we're sending you across the street because we're not done with you yet. This sounds similar, Larry.
Absolutely. It's tragedy. But our state's even worse. It is a privilege to be released before your sentence expiration. In our state, your sentence expires and they continue to hold you. So at least that's one step above us. In Pennsylvania, your parole is a discretionary act because you serve a percentage of your time. In New Mexico, you serve all of your time. And then there's a period following your prison sentence that's called parole. but it should be more appropriately called supervised release. And you're already in that period of supervised release, but if they do not like where you're going to live, then they continue to hold you in prison. That is unconscionable in the United States of America, but it happens here. There are dozens and dozens and maybe even well over 100 people that are trapped in prison here.
That's a lot of people, Larry, because you probably don't have all that many people in prison for there to be that number, like, disproportionately represented.
Well, our entire incarcerated offender population hovers between 6,500 and 7,000.
Georgia's got that almost tenfold. Yep. Almost. Okay. All right, Larry, I have a question for you. I received a phone call from a friend, and I actually have a similar, I've been thinking about the same question. But the difference here for this is he is on unsupervised probation, whereas I've had my sentence terminated, so I'm no longer on supervision at all. It says, the question that he brought up, though, is Halloween is kind of around the corner, and can he decorate? And I said, and he was having an argument with his fiance about it, and she says, I don't want you to get in trouble. And he's like, I can do what I want because I'm on unsupervised probation. And I said, you're both right. What I believe is going to happen is that I think the sheriff's office is going to come around with that little handy clipboard, and they're going to say, hey, on Halloween, 5 o'clock, curfew, don't have lights on, don't have decorations, no candy, blah, blah, blah. I am certain that the sheriff's office is going to come around and do that for me and for him. And you cannot abide by them because I don't see that they have any jurisdiction over this, but I don't think that it would be the best of ideas to do this.
I agree with you. But let's talk about, where is he? What county is he in?
He is in, I think it's Spalding County now. He used to live in a very rural county and just moved a little bit north of there. So he's kind of like in, like, you know, not a metropolis, but a suburb of a metropolis.
Well, if he is in Spalding County, I tend to agree with you, but I think that that may inure to his benefit, because Spalding is one of the two counties that were sued about Halloween, but the requirement to erect signage on Halloween. The National Association for Rational Sexual Offense Laws filed a suit a couple years ago against Spalding and Butts County. And the Butts County litigation is on appeal, but the county of Spalding decided to settle, and they paid out a significant attorney fee award as a part of the settlement. And I think that the county attorney would be a little gun shy if this were to come to their attention, that they're imposing another invented requirement, because as far as I know, there's nothing in the Georgia statutory scheme that in any way prohibits a PFR from decorating or participating. It's only the supervised offender population. But you are correct. We get reports from counties throughout Georgia that they show up regardless of their supervision status, and they tell them, you're not allowed to do these things. And people say, yes, sir. And that's probably is often the best course of action. But in this case, he may benefit from the settlement, because Spalding may be a bit gun shy to impose that on
anybody else. That would be interesting. In all of that, I didn't think of that answer, that they may be a little bit, well, maybe we shouldn't go mess with those people because we do have somebody gunning for our back. But what was the other county that was Butts County? Like, they may still, like, come out guns blazing, like, nope, sign this here, right?
Butts is determined. Sheriff Gary Long, who was reelected last year, Sheriff Long has made it his mission to fight this issue to the Supreme Court, because he put his hand on that Bible.
Right.
And he swore he was going to protect the citizens of Butts County. And he is determined that he's going to have this all the way to the Supreme Court, if that's what it takes. So we are determined that we're going to fight this as well. We being the organization that I serve on the board of, we're going to fight this all the way to the Supreme Court if need be as well. You can't.
That's a cheap endeavor, isn't it, Larry?
It's going to be very expensive, but you can't invent requirements. You did put your hand on the Bible, but remember, the oath was to enforce the law, not to invent the law. And therefore, you're out of line, Sheriff Long, and we're determined to shut you down. And we're also determined to shut down. We're actually targeting Cobb County. We're working on putting together a lawsuit because Cobb County, which is a suburban Atlanta, they are telling PFRs that they have to do things they don't have to do, including giving their work schedule. That is not a part of the Registration Act. Now, your probation officer can very much demand your work schedule because they may want to visit you at work, and they have that prerogative. But you do not have to give your schedule. It's not in the Georgia statute. But that's just one of the many things that Cobb County is imposing. We were hoping it would get better with the elections. We have not gotten any evidence that it's gotten a whole lot better with the new sheriff that was elected that replaced the previous sheriff, Neil Warren, in Cobb County.
Very interesting. So I guess we will follow up with you the first or second week of October and tell you if anybody has come to visit. Like I said, I am positive that the sheriff is going to come knock on my door about it. You do know of people, like I'm not exaggerating that there are people that are just on the registry, not on supervision, that get rounded up on Halloween and or have insane curfews and can't go out and express themselves. Right?
Right. I hear it all the time.
Okay. I just want to make sure. And you, if I'm not mistaken, and I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, but answer, you believe that this is a First Amendment violation for freedom of expression?
Absolutely, I do. I believe it's more than that. It's that and association. You have the right to associate with whomever you choose on a holiday. And association of interacting with people that are under adult supervision, knocking at the door, that is your prerogative to express yourself and to associate with them. And there is no law in Georgia. Now, they will very likely, in the upcoming session of the General Assembly, they will propose such a law. We anticipated that. And they may very well pass that law. We have already anticipated that. And we will challenge that because we don't believe it's constitutional either. We do not believe that you can do that. And therefore, but we're not going to be surprised if they pass a law that says that you can't participate in Halloween.
Very bizarre. I mean, it seems like all of us, forgive me, all of us should change our religion to something pagan oriented that has like Halloween as their day of holiness. And then we claim it as a religious testament, just like the guy did. Packingham posted the religious message on Facebook. I'm pretty sure that's how that got elevated so quickly, is that he posted a religious message and he was only on the registry. Had he posted something like, "Hey mom, everything went great," I don't think it would have had the same sort of impact that he said, "Praise God that it all of that went down for Packingham." So if we all convert to a religion that has Halloween as the day of holiness, then maybe we can make a claim.
I never thought of that.
Okay, Larry, let's move on. What? Go ahead.
I did hear from an attorney in South Georgia that said that in his particular county, which I don't want to name at the moment, but he said that they do tell everyone on the registry to show up for housekeeping. They want to supervise them on Halloween. It's not a large county, so it wouldn't be a lot of people, but they do that. So it's not uncommon. But it's
fortunately, this year, Halloween is on Sunday. So like last year, I'm pretty sure it was on Saturday or Friday. Is this a leap year? This is 21. No. So last year, it was not. It would have been on Saturday night last year. That impinges on everything right there. If it's on Friday or Saturday, man, go have fun. Like, I don't think they're going to bother you on Friday or Saturday night. They're going to bother you on Sunday night.
So, well, we're thinking about doing one of those Halloween marathons if we can find a person to assist us with the long marathon. We didn't do one last year because Halloween was greatly curtailed because of pandemic related concerns, right? But we're thinking about doing. Do you know anybody that might want to help pull one of those together?
Help in what capacity?
Production.
I don't know anybody that does production work like that at all.
You don't? Well, that's what my concern is, but we're thinking about putting one of these together.
Okay. That'll be a Sunday night, man. I don't care. Let's move on, Larry. So there was that question about Halloween lights and curfews and all that stuff. And then, I received a couple comments from people about the polygraph episode that we did. I've totally lost track of numbers. I think it was last weekend. So it was 193 that we did the polygraph. And, so that was where we, partnered with one of the affiliates and we did a phone call over Zoom and we took some questions and stuff like that. And we talked about the polygraph, but a friend of mine wrote in, and I think you're going to get a big kick out of this, Larry, or he called me and we talked about this. He said, He said that the day before he was going to go take a polygraph, he would have a friend come over and like swear him in and be all official and say, look, I need you to give me a polygraph test. And the friend would be like, all right, I'll give you a polygraph, and go through and answer some questions and whatnot. So then when he goes in for the real polygraph and they go, since your last polygraph, have you abided by all the rules and your special conditions? And he would go, in my mind, my last polygraph was last night. So yeah, I've been a perfect person in the last 12 hours. That's an excellent strategy.
That is funny. I don't know that I would recommend it, but it is funny.
In my mind, Larry, if you can convince yourself of the thing, then you're not lying. This is just my own little like tactic of dealing with stuff. But if you believe that you're not lying, if you can believe that what you're telling yourself is true, so if your last polygraph was last night, then you're not lying. So anywho. And then we received another comment from a person that's here in Georgia. He has a conviction from another state. Says, hey, Andy, just passing along some info I got today. I'm still, after 19 years, on supervision, CSL from New Jersey, that's Community Supervision for Life, and mandated to take polygraphs in New Jersey for 11 years. I never took a poly when I moved to Georgia. It was mandated every 6 months until I inquired about it. Like, why would you inquire about it? And then it became magically annual. I was scheduled for a poly next week. The polygraph company called me and said I was no longer required to take a polygraph because I'm not in therapy anymore, and I haven't been in therapy for a decade. And I verified this with my DCS officer. Just info. So, like, you told me a story recently about, like, let sleeping dogs lie, Larry. Like, don't go poke that bee's nest, and if you're not required to do something, don't bother them.
Yeah, but we have a hard time convincing people of that. And I don't know if we're on time, but I can tell the story about the Social Security person.
That's the story I'm referring to. I was not trying to out anybody.
Yeah, so got an old client from back way back that had taken disability and gone back to work in 98, 99, and then gone back on disability benefits. And for some reason, it was an overpayment during some of that period of time. Then the person went back to work again in 2020. And by going to work, that disturbed the file because they had to look at are you entitled to another trial work period. Several components of the file had to be closely examined, and they saw that those payments were made in 1999, 2000 that shouldn't have been. So they assessed an overpayment. So then that fired up us again as representatives to try to negotiate a settlement on the overpayment. So we submitted an offer and compromise, which had been sitting since April or May. And the person just could not live with it anymore. I have to have an answer. Are they going to take my offer and compromise? Well, while it's being considered, the offer, the payments that the person was making toward the overpayment, the reimbursements were suspended. They were paused. But Social Security had forgotten to submit the offer to the right department because of the level of the overpayment. There's various levels that each aspect of the administration can approve. So $1,000 or less is at one level. Then as you go up in amount, there's various levels. And this had to go to about the highest level of approval because the amount. And so when we checked with Social Security, they said, yep, you did have a pause in your payments while we were making a decision. And the decision was never going to be made because it never did get submitted to the right unit. But now that you've brought it to our attention, we will submit the request. And if it's denied, you'll need to start back making payments. So the person could have conceivably gone for the rest of their life without making any payments, but they had to know. They just couldn't live with it. So now they know.
Couldn't live with it. So those were the two comments about. Go ahead.
A lot of stress goes with people when they have things pending. And I'm not a psychologist or expert to know how difficult it is, but it really bothers people when they have things pending and they just can't let it go.
Very well. And then I guess we can, let's do this article real quick that you put in there. Virginia woman, this is from MSN. Virginia woman gets 12 years in prison for one of the biggest coupon scams in U.S. history. Larry, coupons. This isn't Al Capone and like doing all kinds of prohibition kind of things and tax evasion and whatnot, but this is coupons.
It is, but it was a huge scandal, and I don't know what the answer is. I only put it in here really to pose the question. The victims were defrauded of millions. Kimberly Clark Paper Company products, $8.9 million, might as well say $9 million. Procter and Gamble, $2.8 million, might as well say $3 million. Unilever, another manufacturer of consumer products, $2.5 million. And Henkel, which makes cleaning supplies like Dial soap, $1.7 million. So it was a large scam. But as I've said about Martha Stewart when she was in prison, we should put people in prison that we're afraid of that would hurt us if we're out walking our dogs. I want to recover these millions of dollars, and to me, that's the best solution. But you know, this couple, the husband got 7 years, and I guess he was a lesser part of the scam, but she's been sentenced to 12 years in federal prison for that, which she'll serve 85% of. So it's not just PFRs that get harsh sentences. 12 years is a long time for making phony coupons, but the volume of it's what got the 12 years. It was a large scam.
I gotcha. Still. All right. Larry, let's do something. We have an episode that is coming up that patrons have already listened to, and it is an interview that we did with an individual who is now living in Germany. His name is Stephen Witset, and I have received personally a whole lot of feedback from it, from people. And like I said, so I think I released it on Wednesday and it went out to patrons. So only our patrons are able to hear it. And on top of that, they got the full interview, whereas the non-Patreon listeners are only going to get the first hour-ish of the interview. And I wanted to get some feedback from you on what you thought of the interview. And then I also wanted to share some of the comments that people have given us as far as feedback.
If it wasn't my favorite interview in the time we've done this podcast, it was very close. It was an awesome interview. The guy was articulate, very well researched. He understood what he was talking about the German law and European law. He was very reasonable in how he described his experience with law enforcement and his experience with the correctional system in Florida. He gave credit for what they could have done to him versus what they did do to him. I just found him to be amazing. He should be at the top of the list for a guest if we can get him back.
I think he may be patron number one. It says, holy poop. And I adjusted that one. He says, you make me proud to be a patron. You guys are working hard at getting info out and grow your audience and our team. This Stephen Witset River episode was awesome and also gave me inspiration and hope for better days. Bravo and encore. Can't wait to hear him again. Best episode ever. I'm sure River got some new subscribers after being on your podcast. He got at least one. Yours truly. Just an awesome podcast. He was a lot of fun. He was certainly very articulate. I ended up speaking to him a handful of days prior to get everything set up and make sure that all the tech and all that stuff would work and all that. And like instantly, just like a connection, we got along. We're similar ages. We have sort of similar backgrounds. We were both in the Navy back in that time frame and all that stuff. So we had a very, very, it was just an easy conversation where some people you have to like push really hard or pull really hard, but he was just super awesome. And then another one of our patrons, a regular who's actually listening to us in chat tonight, he says, I freaking love this guest. Hell yeah. More of this fella. So I think I'll leave it at that. I have a few other ones that I could, if anybody wants to know, but I assure you, you will not regret. Go over to patreon.com. That's patreon.com. Sign up for the Registry Matters podcast, and just even a buck a month will get you there. You will not regret becoming a patron to hear the bonus content that comes along with this episode. With that, Larry, I think we are ready to go over to Who's That Speaker. You probably don't even remember who the last one was.
I remember everything we've ever said on this podcast.
Everything? All right. Well, last week, or actually it was 2 weeks ago, I played, maybe it was last week. I really don't remember when this was. It was this one.
Run by the strangest collection of misfits, Looney Tunes, since the advent of the Third Reich.
And yeah, that was last week. We played that while we were doing the polygraph episode. And I was kind of surprised that we got a whole bunch of responses, because, like, you recognize the voice, Larry, but I don't know that anybody would recognize the quote per se. But that is, of course, who is that, Larry?
That was Ronald Wilson Reagan.
That is correct. We got like a bunch. So Carl was the first one to write in, and he got the answer. That's Carl in Missouri. Thank you so very much. This one is a little bit off the beaten path, this new one. And so, yeah, we're not going to do it next week because we're having a little bit of a schedule conflict. So there won't be this. So in 2 weeks, we will figure out who wins this one. But this is the who's that speaker this week.
Bible says two men ought not lay together.
Well, neither two women, but I like to watch them do it.
Why did you pick this?
Well, concentrate more on the first speaker where it says the Bible says. That's who we're trying to identify.
Yes.
I put that in there because that is a distinct voice, and I'd be very surprised if we don't have multiple people get that one right. But yeah, the second voice was just for kicks and giggles because of his reaction.
Yes. And I think that many of the people in our sphere have had some sort of same sex type of crime. And in the case of Mr. Whitsett, his crime involved same sex. And like at the height of gay fear, I don't know if that's the right term, but like that's so anyway, that's what that's a reference to, at least in my mind. So what you got to do is email registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Tell me who you think that is, and the first person to get it right will win a prize of me telling your name on the program next time we go around for this. Larry, I don't think we have anything else. We're right at the right time slot. Is there anything else you want to cover before we get out of here?
Do you want to promote the NARSL conference and the special guest that we're going to have? Thanks to our loyal patron, we have awarded that prize, and that person's coming to the conference, and it's going to be an awesome experience.
That it is. So, yes. So our generous patron offered up to help sponsor someone to go to the conference, and that has been taken advantage of. And when I had the dialogue with the person, and he tells me his name, and I see the last name, I said, like, the Von Baron? And it was kind of coincidental because we had just done the polygraph episode, so we had talked about Von Baron during that program. And Von Baron is the person from Colorado who pled the fifth about taking a polygraph, I believe.
That is correct.
And so I was like, that one? He goes, yeah, that's the one. So if I'm not mistaken, Larry, we are going to we're going to do a live program at the NARSL conference, probably Saturday night, which I think is the 10th. It might be the 11th of October in Houston. And he's going to be our special guest. So we'll do a live program with him, which is going to be awesome. But then also you asked about promoting the NARSL conference. I like a whole bunch of the people that listen to this podcast are going to be there. So by all means, come up and say hi. I'm sure you know what I look like by now if you've been watching YouTube videos. And there's a whole mess of speakers. There's Emily Horowitz that's going to be there, Jill Levinson, Paul Dubling, of course. You're going to be there. I don't know. Are you doing a presentation?
Not this time, but we will be doing the recording. And I believe that since the conference kicks off on the 8th on Friday, it would be Saturday night, the 9th. And then we'll conclude at noon on Sunday, the 10th.
I gotcha. Yeah, so that would be the 9th. You're right. I agree with you. But certainly, I guess tickets are still available and hotel rooms are still available.
Yes, the overwhelming demand, the hotel extended the cutoff date, and we signed an addendum to have more rooms added to the block, and they've extended it through September 30th. You get a hotel room with a buffet breakfast up to two individuals for $104 at the Marriott. This is not at the Dew Drop Inn, but it's at the Marriott at the Houston Hobby Airport. If you're going to come to the conference, book in our block. You get the perks of the free parking and the breakfast that's included. And if you're going to fly on the airplane, use Southwest Airlines. They don't rip you off. They don't charge you ticket change fees. They don't charge you cancellation fees. They don't charge you bag check fees. But go to southwest.com You won't find them on any of the third-party bookers. So people tell me all the time, well, Larry, I didn't find any Southwest flights. Well, you didn't go to southwest.com. That's the only place you'll find Southwest flights.
I have been poking around their website personally lately for flights. Also, I will tell you, like, personal experience, we did this at the conference a couple years ago, and it's a really, I mean, it's a certainly nice hotel, big atrium thing, so the restaurant and all that stuff's, like, in the center. It's a great place to meet people that are active in the movement, and you're certainly going to walk away with a whole bunch of information and get recharged that this is something worth fighting for, and with people that are actively fighting it.
Absolutely.
Larry, we got a new patron. This came in actually at somewhere during the Polygraph episode last week, and we got a new patron named Michael, and we are at 99, Larry. We are at 99 patrons, and when we hit 100, I was practicing today. You can see my saxophone right there. I will be playing a saxophone solo with the song of your choice, and then I will play a song for patrons. I got to probably promote that thing again and get people to vote. I'm pretty sure I know which song they're going to pick. And so thank you very much, Michael, for becoming a patron. And here it is Saturday night. That's when we normally record the podcast at 7 p.m. Eastern. And you can find all of the show notes over at registrymatters.co. You can leave voicemail at 747-227-4477. Email me at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. And support us on Patreon, which is patreon.com/registrymatters. With that, Larry, I bid you a happy, happy, happy weekend for the rest of it. And I will talk to you tomorrow or Monday or Tuesday or sometime very soon. I hope you have a great night.
Thank you for having me back.
Of course. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to FYP.